so much in the news at the moment about democracy, the free market and democracy, that we begin to wonder, in fact, what democracy does mean, or at least a lot of members of the working class who are not in a political movement can't really have any idea what democracy means. They mean it means to them something like, you know, being able to have your say at a local public inquiry or something, one of those where they take no damn notice of whatever conclusions you reach.
Well, better cross that out.
We want to look at it both from the point of view of the way capitalism is handling it, and also from the point of view of what will happen in a really democratic society, one which is based upon democracy. And we hope we shall be able to look at those topics, a number of aspects of those topics. But it, even more than last year, this is a programme in which the discussion is at least as important as the contributions from the speakers, because we are hoping really to explore, not just to have something delivered to us. And in fact, no speaker is capable of delivering the sort of thing that we would really desire here, a thorough understanding of democracy. I don't understand it. Every time I start to look into it, every time I start to look at the way the party tries to be democratic, I can see that there are great difficulties. And I think we do need to begin the process of exploration. We're not going to solve it this weekend either, that's a certainty. But I do think that we've got to look at it very carefully. We might even, at the extreme, come to the conclusion that there is no point in the Socialist Party trying to support democracy because it's impractical. Well, a lot of supporters of capitalism.
We'll cross that out as well.
How's that? Right. So that I don't step on any more toes, I'll shut up now and let Richard Eddycar get on with it.
Title of this talk is Democracy Worth Saving? If I give the wrong answer to this, I'll quit up the entire weekend, haven't I? So I've got to be very careful. I took a taxi when I got out here. I had a lot of stuff to write down and I was loaded down. And when I got in the cab, the driver said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Fircroft College." He said, "What's on there?" I said, "It's a weekend on democracy." He says, "What, foreigners then, are they?" The first question that came to mind when I started to think about this talk was something of a puzzler. How on earth do you talk about saving something that you haven't got anyway? Somebody once said there is no greater farce, than to talk of democracy. To begin with, it is a lie. It has never existed in any country. Bernard Shaw didn't think much of it either. He said, "Democracy is a device that ensures we shall be governed no better than we deserve." This cynicism is completely understandable. We live in a society in which there are 60 military dictatorships practicing extreme oppression, torture, and murder as a matter of routine government. Of the 170 or more independent states that exist today, strangely enough, 90% either claim to be democratic or include the word democratic in their title. Even in those countries where there are regular elections held, where all adults have the right to vote, power remains concentrated in the hands of a few. But those who wield the greatest power are by no means necessarily those elected to govern. Civil servants, economic advisors, financiers, bosses, military commanders, religious leaders even, all or any may have an unhealthy impact upon government decisions. And these, of course, are people not elected. And wherever we look, every single regime on earth, whatever they may call themselves, operates by minority control. Every country on earth practices censorship, secrecy, and deception, fundamental denials of democracy. At the same time, the prevailing ideas of government invariably invade every aspect of our daily lives through art, literature, theatre, publishing, broadcasting, morals and education, etc. And the distorting glow of the cathode ray tube brings their desired persuasions right into our homes. Sometimes, skillfully presenting, as in the case of the Balkans War, a selective but powerfully persuasive perception of one facet of that conflict. At others, a routine violation of truth, commonly known as the news. And in the name of free choice, granting broadcasting rights to powerful media moguls in the certain knowledge that they can be confidently relied upon to produce programs of an ever descending level of quality, many of which are frankly an insult to human intelligence. In democratic parlance, this is known as giving the people what they think they want. It would never do, of course, to attempt to raise the human spirit, to try to broaden our experience or increase our knowledge and awareness through such media. Occasionally, this does happen, as it would prove counterproductive to the government were it otherwise, but never too often than is good for us, and certainly not too often than is good for them. Real challenges to the fundamental perceptions of the market economy, majority exploitation, and the desirability of money-based security are rarely permitted. Any controversial opinion is usually contained within carefully defined parameters. The problem for socialists is that for us, democracy means something entirely different than it does to most people. According to Chambers, which, as many of you know, is my favorite dictionary because it is the only one that tells jokes. I might as well tell you one of them now just to curb your curiosity. The description in Chambers of an eclair is a chocolate-covered confection, long in shape and short in duration. It's full of them. Wonderful dictionary. Anyway, the Chambers definition of democracy is a form of government in which supreme power is vested in the people collectively and is administered by them or by officers appointed by them. Well, if you take out the word government and substitute society, or better still, community, a word without what Martin Buber called the attendant structural poverty of a word like society, and it becomes a pretty neat definition. But if you ask the British electorate, as Ron so kindly mentioned for me, if you ask the British electorate for a definition, most would probably fall rather short of Chambers. Most, I suspect, would settle for something rather less demanding, like a parliamentary party system in which government is chosen by periodic free elections. Few, if any, would reflect the opinion of an Australian chap posed the question by a TV reporter. He replied, "Democracy says that 99 half-wits make a better decision than one man who knows all the facts." Who is this one man, I wondered? Surely not Jack Straw. But in fact, I came across the one man in the literature here, and I'm going to show him to you. This is a very precious book because it's got beautiful pictures on every other page of The Deserted Village by Oliver Goldsmith, and this is one of my favourites. And here you see all the yokels outside their pub. You can have a look at it later. And there is this distinguished grey-haired gentleman walking by with his cane, the village teacher. And they're saying, And still they gazed, and still the wonder grew that one small head could carry all he knew. But even the most limited form of democracy is inevitably threatened by catastrophic economic upheaval or major war, or indeed any such circumstance that the elected government decrees to be a state of national emergency. As Aristotle observed long ago, any democracy put to the strain is soon supplanted by oligarchy. For socialists, democracy depends upon people's ability and readiness to cooperate together in taking considered decisions about the administration of the community and to act accordingly. In capitalism, alas, it means the abdication of responsibility by most workers who accept complicity in the actions by their rulers. In capitalist democracy, Tweedledum and Tweedledee falsely present themselves as deadly rivals, offering a genuine alternative choice. In fact, they offer no more of a real choice than that offered to a condemned prisoner, democratically invited to choose between the rack, the wheel, and the fire. Not an easy choice. Yet millions of voters actually believe they are making a significant decision and dutifully divest themselves of any further responsibility by going to the ballot box every few years and electing yet another faithful servant of the system. The sad assumption that their action may affect in any important way the unjust and exploitative system that their elected leaders represent, that by some miracle, by some strange alchemy, this lot will not deceive and manipulate them like the last lot, is a triumph of the Machiavellian ideal, creating the illusion of freedom while never relinquishing control. Some, it must be said, the whole exercise is driven by a negative reaction, a sizable percentage motivated simply by the desire to keep one disastrous party out, rather than being inspired by the pre-election ideal, and vision of the equally disastrous party they decide to support. But negative or positive, such popular consent is the means by which capitalist politicians, who by the rules of the game, the circumstances of power, are bound to act frequently against the interests of those they claim to serve, by this device turn the electorate into their accomplices. The fraud which is capitalist democracy, providing a ready justification for whatever action best serves the interests of the system. Even were a party, try to use your imagination, even were a party prompted by sincere and noble motives, with principles above suspicion, even were that party to be elected, their leaders would be compelled to act against those principles, to betray their supporters in order to retain power. Democratically elected parties the same as any other. All governments, by whatever method they acquire office, legitimately pursue actions, deception, robbery, murder, which are forbidden to the individuals within that democracy. These extreme measures, invoked to defend the state against internal and external threats, invariably prove disastrous for the working class. It is unfortunately true that even where capitalist democracy appears to tolerate minority opinion, it only does so as long as its advocates remain sufficiently ineffectual to allow their deviation without undue risk to the state. Even so, they will rarely be given the equal opportunity to argue their case. Indeed, the intolerance often shown by the majority against minority attitudes and behaviour frequently serves as an excuse for their suppression on the grounds that they threaten the stability of society by undermining its fundamental beliefs. Ironically, but all too rarely, the truth about this wonderful political democracy is expressed most succinctly by its own advocates. In a letter to his friend, the artist Duncan Grant, who lived in a lovely house in Sussex I visited recently, John Maynard Keynes once wrote, "I work for a government I despise, the ends that I find criminal." And that abysmal American president Woodrow Wilson opined, "The truth is, we are all caught in a great economic system which is completely heartless." 10 years ago, I participated in a debate at the Cambridge Union on the subject, "This House believes that the freedom of individuals is more important than the security of the state." My opponent was a former world debating champion and Cambridge law professor. Regrettably, I have to report that he cheated. During the debate, I gave a definition of the state, perhaps undiplomatically, taken from the Oxford Dictionary. It read, "The body politic as organized for supreme civil rule and government." I spoke first and could only be permitted to make a further contribution, these were the rules, with the permission of the opposers. The former world debating champion then gave his own definition of the state. "The state," he said, "is everybody." When I tried to object, they refused to allow me to speak. And when I urged my supporting speaker, chosen for me by the law faculty, to do so, he informed me that he agreed with his tutor. Astonishingly, in an assembly of several hundred people, mainly law students, pillars of our society in embryo, not one raised a dissenting voice to this crap definition. Treacherously, not even my own son, who was in the audience. The point is, he rather enjoyed it, the point is that the Oxford Dictionary definition of the state, the body politic organized for supreme civil rule and government, equally embraces every form of government, essentially united them all in common cause, whether they are styled democratic, totalitarian, or despotic. The last time I spoke on democracy, which was at the Ruskin Summer School, some comrades felt I was not critical enough of the present system, so I've tried to atone this evening. Those of you who came to my talk on Kosovo will remember I told you one of my favourite stories about the comedy scene that got the longest laughter in history. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Jack Benny, always portrayed as the meanest man in the entire universe. And the longest laughter in history, this was while he was doing his act, somebody rushed on with a gun and said, "Your money or your life." And he was dumbstruck. But in telling this story, I related the time when I was once dumbstruck myself, when I went into a pub in Brighton and ordered egg and chips off a menu that didn't include egg and chips, but included egg, ham and chips. And they said they couldn't serve me. And my friends still laugh about it. I was actually dumbstruck. Anyway, I then said at the meeting that I'd be dumbstruck again if somebody asked me the question, which is worse, capitalist compassion or capitalist philanthropy? And now I would have to add, having done this talk, capitalist democracy. To sum up this introduction then, capitalist democracy, conveniently served, just to make it clear, corrupt, cheating, lying, murdering, warmongering, dominating, callous, oppressive and exploitative rulers of a grossly unjust, privileged and obscene political system all over the world. And not one of us, however free and revolutionary we strive to become, not one of us can fail to be affected to some degree by the pernicious, poisonous, crippling ideas and attitudes dispensed and disseminated by that system all over the world. Nevertheless, having sent you all into deep despondency, nevertheless, even this pathetic apology for democracy is worth saving. Firstly, because the only reasonable, practical, desirable, and realistic springboard for any fundamental change to the present system is universal franchise. One person, one vote. But how can one person, one vote be meaningful when even where it is established, some are millionaires and others paupers? Yet we may also ask why we should consider the right to vote meaningless when those in power are so reluctant to grant it. And even where they do, take care to ensure that sufficient information necessary to enable the electorate to make an informed choice is never provided. Critics argue, of course, that this only confirms their position, that the entire electoral system is a sham. The concept of universal suffrage an irrelevance, a trap to lure the unwary into the artfully spun web of capitalism and state control. That the moment anyone enters the arena of power and politics with all its attendant paraphernalia of posturing, ego-tripping leaders, whips, and fiercely imposed party lines, they become hopelessly compromised. That once you have cast your vote for Tweedledum or Tweedledee, you thereby offer tacit agreement to the very process that keeps us all enslaved. As Alan Corran put it, democracy consists of choosing your dictators after they have told you what they think you ought to know. Let us be honest and admit that, as we have seen, these are powerful points not to be lightly dismissed. They must be persuasive, goddammit. After all, I argued them myself for almost 30 years, and I kept persuaded that time. But of course, there are ways of participating in this democratic process without making a contribution to the machinations of the establishment. Aha, our opponent might exclaim triumphantly. Even if that were possible, which we don't accept, you socialists actually go the whole hog and field candidates. So there, got you. Yes, we do. But there is an important, a very important qualification to be made. Unlike any other party candidates, we do not seek to form a government. On the contrary, we want to abolish the bloody thing. We vigorously campaign against all forms of government, and nor are we bedazzled by all of the electoral shenanigans. Not for us, the phony promises of other parties. In fact, the only promise we can truthfully make to the voters is the one I made when I was a candidate in Holborn and St Pancras. When I was asked by a heckler, what are you going to do for me if elected? I said, bugger all, mate. And of course, that is it. Not because we are unfeeling swine. Well, not all of us anyway. Not because of that. But because our interest is to convince the electorate that change, real change, can only occur when they desire to do something about it themselves. Also, we consider it to be absolutely vital to show our support and encouragement to workers in other countries that struggle for the right to vote, and in that struggle often face imprisonment, torture, or even death. What would they think if those of us who have the vote never bothered to take part in what they are dying for? We have to support our comrades and fellow workers everywhere in the world. Or those places where, instead of apathy, disillusionment, cynicism, or plain work-related fatigue causing the electorate to neglect their hard-won franchise, queuing up for hours, queues bigger than Wimbledon, some cases days, in order to cast the vote they had so preciously won. Non-participation by those of us who have the chance is not only betrayal, but tragically mistaken. The reason governments are wary of free elections, well, fairly free elections, well, all right then, not very free elections at all, but the only reason they're wary of them is that deep down themselves, whatever they pretend, they know that it is the one process of all the processes with the capacity to end their supremacy once and for all. And since they themselves are incessantly trumpeting their commitment to the democratic ideal, the more we cement it by our active participation, the harder it becomes for them ever to abandon it. Though, alas, they still have the power to do so. In a recent local government election, or in the recent government elections, local government elections, below 30% bothered to vote. And in some areas, it was only 10%. Looking at those figures, I only wish that I could believe that this abstinence was a consequence of profound political analysis, but I strongly doubt it. Already, politicians and commentators are suggesting that in the case of trade unions, for instance, a low turnout voting in favour of a strike should not be taken as sufficient approval to validate it. But that sounds like a double-edged sword to me, if ever I saw one. Another position sometimes advanced is that democracy only matters when a socialist society has been achieved. A foolish, I was going to say bollocks, but I've restrained myself, a foolish and dangerous argument that I should examine presently. Article 19 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, I'm not going to examine that presently because I couldn't fit it in, but no doubt you can ask me questions about it later. Article 19 of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights says this: everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. And this right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media, regardless of frontiers. Nobody of sound mind imagines this declaration is rigorously pursued in any country in the world. In many, regrettably, it is studiously ignored. But where we can, we should surely use it to test and challenge its intention, especially in view of that wonderful phrase, regardless of frontiers, especially so in the struggle going on now to preserve free exchange on the internet and prevent government agencies from controlling it, as is their deepest heart's desire. All socialists should welcome and strive to extend and consolidate every concession to free communication and free assembly, and any concessions granted by governments and international authorities, and to explore and exploit any promising statement made by them, however hypocritical we think it is, and however inadequate we think the concessions may be. The most important reform for socialists, however, would surely be the achievement of the right to vote being given to every single human being. And I'm not even clear, never have been, whether it can even be designated a reform, since it represents to us the fundamental basis for democratically inspired change. The obstacles confronting such a possibility, it is true, are awesome. Presenting revolutionary ideas at the hustings, for one thing, is growing ever more expensive. I'm going to tell you something now that not many people will know about me. My father was a Freemason. And as the son of a Freemason, I would have a special privilege because I'm a Lewis. And if you ever look at the Freemasons' history and their objectives and their statements of policy, they have one very interesting. They claim anyone can join a lodge, except women, of course. But anyone else, any man could join the lodge. But if you look at their little book, it says, if you can't afford to pay the fees, you can't join. But it's a very good way of doing it. And of course, that is exactly what the government is doing with elections, making them money-oriented, charging more and more to put up a candidate, and taking more and more in payment of airtime. Increasingly, elections are influenced by the size of a party's budget. Socialists may disagree about the desirability of standing in particular elections at specific times and the tactics employed, but it is the single mechanism we have that enables us to measure the extent of support that exists at any time for effecting the kind of transition that we seek in the only possible and lasting manner by majority consent of free and cooperative human beings. Secondly, democracy is worth saving because every other alternative proposal for fundamental change is unreasonable, impractical, undesirable, and unrealistic. Well, every is a slight exaggeration, because when I wrote this talk, I could only think of two possibilities. So that's what you're going to get. We have all of us at some time encountered the wild-eyed, ranting, buckets of blood, mount the barricades, would-be people's heroes, who view the prospect of a popular violent uprising through a rose-coloured romantic haze. Not all, or even most of those who favour the forceful overthrowing of the state, however, fit this stereotype. Many are thoughtful, sincere, rational people who genuinely believe that waiting for change through the ballot box is impossibly utopian, who are convinced that such a process of prolonged persuasion only plays into the hands of our rulers, ensuring them of everlasting security of tenure in the halls of power. They reason that with ever-increasing spread of nuclear capability and the relentless and uncaring, almost systematic destruction of the environment, time is a luxury that we can ill afford. Armed revolution is the only method, they say, which would enable an immediate and secure seizure of control. Any signs of a significant will for change, evidence at the ballot box, would quickly be subverted, they argue, by the state, if necessary, by military intervention. Well, be that as it may, I have to say that even the 10% at the ballot far outnumber those who possess the guns and armaments necessary to pose a threat to the vast armory controlled by states. But since we are all victims of the contagion of capitalism, perhaps the necessary armaments will be supplied by prescription. I must say that I have always regarded the proposition that overthrowing a government because you deplore their methods of violent suppression by using the methods of violent suppression as seriously misguided at best and dangerously loopy at worst. Those who advocate it must be hooded and blinkered not to be aware of the inevitable consequences. Whereas past experience has repeatedly demonstrated, power obtained by violent struggle inevitably needs to be maintained by an oppressive combination of military posturing, armed policing, lying and spying, informing and imprisoning, threatening, torturing and executing. Strangely similar symptoms to those practiced by the corrupt and vicious regime that was previously in control. Rebels and radicals who fail to conform to the new authoritarianism are likely to be crushed with even greater ferocity than was ever manifested by those whom they have overthrown. Invariably, such attempts are led by a so-called revolutionary vanguard, self-appointed leaders with a 100% strike rate at totally betraying their luckless followers. Power acquired by violence must inevitably be defended by violence, because it will be threatened constantly from outside and from below. Cooperation cannot be enforced forever by coercion. However ruthless those who try it are, they are only sowing the seeds of their eventual demise, for they are making the serious mistake of treating those they govern with utter contempt. Though there can be no doubt that it may seem an eternity to those who are the victims of such regimes. True enough that even in the most developed democratic society, mistakes and misjudgments will be made. But unlike those based upon coercion, and since there will be no absolute truth of any kind, the attendant hostility engendered by the irresistible force of violent revolution encountering the supposed immovable object of entrenched ideology. An altogether nobler, though sadly similarly naive notion, is that change will occur when evolved human beings, individually developing enlightened attitudes of cooperation, but without the need for any political forethought about democracy or administration, somehow comprise a majority of the world's population. Obviously, should by some astounding circumstance such a situation occur, it would be chaotic. Having loftily disdained the necessity of understanding the complex nature of modern industrial society, or dirtying their hands with the viciousness and nastiness of capitalism, and hopelessly deficient in an understanding of global priorities, they would be unable to do much else, alas, than sit under their tree and hope. This is because, let me say that many of my friends embrace this perspective, this is because they have seriously erred by treating the concept of democracy as a dry political concept and a purely political concept, which brings me to my final point, trying to keep within the allotted time of the tape. Thirdly, democracy is worth saving because it is a concept which is crucially important, not only politically, but philosophically and psychologically as well. I have always regarded the widespread lack of self-belief shared by too many human beings as one of the great psychological barriers that socialists encounter. The dismal, life-sucking acceptance that the inequality and exploitation that so dominates their lives and is in so much in evidence in a capitalist society is the inescapable and irreversible curse of human nature. When socialists speak of a community based upon cooperation, freely given without coercion, of free access of democratic administration, but the absence of government, a society where the basic needs of every human being and more are unfailingly met, often the listener will nod sagely and say, yes, that would be very nice, but it's impossible. It's against human nature. Yet, such an exchange, though seemingly fruitless, is frequently redeemed when, oddly enough, the sage immediately excludes himself from his gloomy conclusion concerning human incapability. My favourite piece of British Rail graffiti reads, "Democracy is too good to share with just anybody." And it makes us laugh, and it makes us laugh, but it makes us laugh at a sinister assumption all too prevalent. It is an elitist assumption that most human beings are congenitally incapable of becoming free enough to aspire to uncoerced cooperation. That only a select few, will ever be able to explore their potential to the required degree. Yet, unless we assume that we are all educable, that all possess the ability to independently exercise conscious choice, we might as well give up. Capitalist democracy depends on containing that dynamic potential, keeping it in check. Socialist democracy depends upon it flourishing. Socialism and democracy are complementary, more than complementary. They are indivisible. And while people often recoil from a word like socialism, mind shut down as you slam the door on the encyclopedia salesman, because they are filled with so many false interpretations, while it is sometimes difficult for them to reject the concept of government, an extension of democracy is an idea more readily acceptable. And democracy is not just about how we conduct ourselves politically, though that aspect, of course, is important, and heaven knows we have to try hard enough at that. But there is much more to it. It is a concept that pervades our lives. We may grandly talk of freedom, but many who claim it woefully fail to understand its implications, for freedom cannot exist without constraint. In asserting ours, we are bound to consider the effects of our actions upon the freedom claimed by others. That is not moral imperative, but the golden rule of harmonious living. It's common sense. It is not demanding that we behave like saints, simply that we respect the right of others to be free also. It is perfectly true that a democratic society can only result from the exercise of free choice. In that sense, democracy is a byproduct of freedom. But in a social context, and this is the point, so sadly missed by my Tolstoyan anarchist friends, in a social context, it is the other way round. Freedom can only exist as a byproduct of democracy. If you show respect and tolerance to others and try to be aware of their desire to be free, and if sometimes you restrain your own impulses as they might infringe, you are tempering your freedom with democratic restraint. Without the concept of democracy, decisions affecting the whole world community could not be clearly and fairly made, since the particular interest of individuals could easily obscure the larger picture. Democracy as an idea is already alive in people's hearts and minds, and where they imagine they have it, even if they are complacent, you can be damn sure that they do not want to lose it. An exciting learning experience. It is a foolish notion to believe that starving human beings are ever going to place philosophical attitudes above feeding their families. But it is a reasonable supposition that the misery of starving human beings will only end when the vibrant possibility of a democratic society becomes a reality. As socialists, we are committed to oppose the mad, dangerous and deluded world of globe-trotting statesmen, nuclear missile races, tele-controlled minds, daydreams of violence and power worship. And we should do so with all the energy we can spare, which right now, in my case, isn't very much, for which I apologise. Not many jokes tonight, but it wasn't very jokey when I was doing it. I wasn't feeling very jokey. Rare for me. But we have no choice but to oppose this on the basis that the extension and refinement of democratic principles is the only certain way to eradicate the misery, injustice and poverty which is the legacy of capitalist democracy. If we ever conclude that democracy is not worth saving, it will be a sad day for us all. In trying to convey it as a philosophical as well as a political concept, an idea I'm quite clear about in my head and which I would like to develop, I'm not sure that I've dwelt long enough on it to succeed. But democracy is, I believe, the single open window to an unchanged society. I believe with all my being that it is a life-enhancing, brilliant and fulfilling concept. And I remain convinced even now that it is a rising and not a setting sun, and it must be saved.